This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 106. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. So what's the word this week, Rob?
Well, we just launched the Hittail Basecamp integration that I talked about last week. So it's all live. If you go to hittail.com/basecamp, you get a brief walkthrough, some screenshots of how it all works. And I'm pretty excited. Like I said, it's really, I mentioned it was the first integration we've done, but it's actually the second, I realized, because the first one was with the one-click article service. But that one was written by me. On this one, my product manager really banged this one out, and it's all architected well. And I think I told you he wrote an OAuth library in classic ASP from scratch. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine. I wouldn't definitely not have done that. I wouldn't have had the coding fortitude to sit down and do that. Mm-hmm. But anyways, we're excited. You know, we're both going to start a little bit of promotion. We're kind of doing a soft launch right now. We just want to get more people using it just to make sure it's all good, and also have a little bit of paid acquisition with some Hittail and Basecamp stuff going on. So it's pretty good. How about you?
Well, I have a new developer starting in a couple of weeks. I just kind of worked out some arrangements with him. We're going to try doing some stuff for about 3 weeks or so and see how it works out, and then kind of reevaluate things from there. So hopefully that works out.
AutoShark?
It'll be working on other stuff first. And then if everything works out, then probably transition him over to working on AutoShark.
Got it.
As I said, it's a trial period and we'll just see how it goes. But I really need somebody who I can put on AutoShark to work on some of the core guts of it. I've been working on a lot of this database synchronization code for AutoShark, and I'm about at the point where I can actually start testing it. But I have all these to-do comments in there of like different events and things that should be logged. So, you know, some of them have security implications, some of them just have synchronization implications, and I haven't actually implemented any of the login code behind it. And if I had to go look, there's probably close to 100 places where I've literally documented to do log this, or, you know, to do make sure you double check this data, etc. So to be honest about it, it's not necessarily worth your time to be doing that. I mean, there's other places that your time is better spent.
Right. And that's the thing is, you know, my 12-year career writing software, I've always gold-plated everything, especially as a consultant and I was a salaried employee for a credit card company for years. Like, you wrote things to the nines. And so when I say I'm a hack, what I mean is a hack compared to that, where I would spend weeks writing this single routine and testing every possible option and doing all kinds of stuff. And I just don't do that anymore. I get kind of the minimum viable function out and then revisit it later. And the thing is that I can just move so quickly, right? If there is actually a bug or any type a problem, I can go in and edit this stuff, and it's not a two-day process to get a change into production like it used to be. So it's more of taking advantage of your agility as a very small startup or a very small software company. You can really be much more fast-moving than larger competitors. So you have different pros and cons than a larger company maybe building the same software.
Right. I mean, there's just different priorities when you're working on stuff. That's really all it comes down to.
Well, hey, if you haven't checked out episode 36 of the Stack Exchange podcast, it's definitely worth a listen. It retells in grave detail their Hurricane Sandy story of lugging those buckets of gasoline up the stairs mm-hmm. after they lost power. We briefly mentioned it last week, but I heard the episode. It's just to hear the kind of that they had like 8 or 9 people on this podcast. And it's a round table. And they're just telling their story of, you know, it's midnight on this day and then the power goes out. And then one guy had a knife and another guy had a plastic vodka bottle that they cut the bottom out of and used as a funnel for the gas. I mean, it was just so cool to hear the innovation and just the get it doneness of the entrepreneurs, right? They didn't sit around complaining. They just figured out how to make it work and how to lug this gas up the thing to keep. It was Fog Creek Software and Squarespace are the kind of the two people on this podcast. So pretty cool story.
Yeah, that is cool. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. I've got some time up in New York that I'm going to be spending down there again. So I've got a 3-hour drive back and forth, and definitely be listening to that though.
Nice. What else is going on?
Oh, you know what? I think that you had said that you tried Facebook ads.
I did indeed.
I'm going to be doing that soon. My wife is kind of venturing out to actually start her own business at this point. She's a certified Zumba instructor. She's had enough people approach her to teach at different places that she's decided to kind of take the next step and start building up her own fitness company. She was asking me about how to, not necessarily how to drive people to her to her classes and stuff, but just kind of talking about some of the issues that she's got with, I've got to make sure that I have this number of people there. And if I don't, then I either break even or lose money. And I just kind of offered to help her drive some people there. And my first thought was, well, this seems perfect for using Facebook ads.
Absolutely. I really agree. I think that's a good choice because it's definitely a consumer type thing. Now, for people who don't know what Zumba is.
It's kind of a dance fitness. There's kind of a Zumba fitness organization that oversees it. And there's all these rules and regulations about how you can use their logo and brand and everything else. Mm-hmm. So she can't have a brand name that says Zumba in it or anything like that. But it's very well tied to overall health and fitness. And it incorporates a lot of dance moves. So she'll teach at Curves, which Curves is a fitness facility that is exclusively for women. And she also teaches at like the YWCA. And then there's a couple of independent fitness studios around that she goes into. So she's been subbing for different classes. And somebody had said, I can't do this class anymore. Can you do it? Or do you want to take it over? And she said, well, I'll take it over if you're not going to do it anymore. But I kind of want control over everything at that point. You know, I'm no longer going to be just doing it as a substitute. And so she's going to essentially expand from there.
That's cool. Yeah, Facebook is neat for geographically targeting like that. A mutual friend of ours was actually trying to relocate, and his wife worked for a government agency that would only transfer her job if she could find someone at the new location to swap with her. And so he went onto Facebook and targeted that location and that government agency, because you can say people who work for and type it in. And so he did that and was showing ads to like say, do you want to move to X, you know, where they currently lived? And he got some people to come through. And I don't know that he ever actually, that's where they actually found the person or not, but he definitely got inquiries and he just had like a Google Doc form or some, you know, email link or something and people could drop him a line. So it's pretty cool with local stuff. It's super easy to target across a lot more demographics than any other system I've ever seen.
Right. She already has like a Facebook fan page set up that, you know, she's going on there and letting people know, because one of the issues she has is if there aren't enough people attending, then sometimes they have to cancel depending on the location. So there are, you know, there's usually posts that go out on Facebook that say, hey, if you're, please RSVP or let us know if you're going to be able to make it tonight. And then they'll cancel class within like an hour so that people aren't driving there and then find out that it's canceled. And that was what she was thinking that she would be using Facebook for. And I said, well, you have access to, or you can get access through the Facebook ad system to all the people in this geographic area. And you can advertise explicitly to those people. And I don't think that was something she'd ever really considered before. And I don't think that any of the other instructors she's worked with have done anything like that either. It'll be interesting to see how it all turns out.
I agree. Keep us posted. Mm-hmm. I want to give a shout of thanks to Andrea Conti. He put together a detailed list of the podcasts that we mentioned in episode 104, because I just had it as kind of a bulleted list, and he put up all the links and he put it into a nice HTML table. And so that's now live in episode 104 in the show notes. So I just wanted to thank him for that. So Mike and I are very pleased to have with us today Brennan Dunn. He's a longtime Micropreneur Academy member. He also runs his own consulting firm, founder of PlanScope, and that's at planscope.io, which is project management software for freelancers. It's a software as a service application. Now, he's also written an ebook for freelancers. He has a podcast. He does workshops, all kinds of stuff. But before we get into that, I wanted Brennan to say hi to everybody.
Hey, everyone.
So talk to us a little bit about just maybe a 1 or 2 minute intro, kind of where you come from, what you've been up to the last few years, and how you found yourself launching PlanScope, you know, having an ebook and workshop and everything.
Sure. 6 years ago, I went out on my own and became a freelancer. And a little over 2 years ago, I decided to grow a company. Well, really, I got so much work that I really had to scale. I kind of went out on a whim and decided to open up a brick and mortar consultancy. And we grew to 10 people. And it was a rush, but really, I was bit by the product bug, and I really wanted to escape consulting once and for all and just kind of build products that I owned and produced recurring revenue for me, because consulting can be extremely draining. Yeah, so I decided to, really what happened first was I took Amy Hoy's 30 by 500 class, and I also, at the same time, signed up for the Micropreneur Academy. So I did my research. I discovered that there was a need for something like PlanScope, and I built it and launched it at LessConf last year, I believe last February. And it's been growing pretty steadily, but the problem with SaaS revenue is even at a 10% growth rate, when you're starting from zero, it's still going to take a while to kind of become really that profitable. So basically, I promoted somebody at the consultancy to run it in my absence. And I've been heads down on products ever since. And last summer, I released a book, which in turn led me to managing a newsletter for freelancers. And just recently, I launched my first online workshop. So all of it really appeals to the same audience, freelancers, and they all kind of feed off each other. So that's kind of my last 6 years in a nutshell.
Very nice. So your consultancy is still running kind of in the background. Is that right?
It is. Most of the people that used to work for me full time have now been converted back to independent contractors. And the guy, Zach, who used to lead business development, I really promoted him to COO. And really, I get a once a week phone call with updates and how we're doing and everything else.
Very cool. So you are very much working on your business, not in your business, I would say.
Correct.
We're going to be talking about moving from consulting to products. And this is something that all three of us on this podcast here, you know, have either done or are in the process of doing. And I think it's a very common path. And even if folks are simply moving from salaried employment to products, it can often be, you know, a similar type of setup where you're just trying to buy out enough time, enough of your time to actually get an app off the ground. And as you said, if you have a SaaS app, you do tend to need a pretty long runway in order to make it there. So I guess the first question, and you kind of partially addressed this already, but you mentioned that, you know, consulting obviously brings in good revenue. So what is your motivation? Why do you thirst to own products?
I think it's because I know a lot of product owners, and I know that they are significantly happier than I ever was working 12 hours a day, managing a consultancy, going through the churn of client after client, and really having no ownership at the end of the day of anything I produce. So products were always kind of, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel, and people were paying me to build products for them. So I had everything I needed to build my own. The problem being that, you know, consulting, like an illicit drug, gives you an immediate benefit, whereas products tend to take a little longer.
Right. So consulting is like an illicit drug and products are like exercise, perhaps?
Yeah, I've always actually compared consulting to crack cocaine.
How about you, Mike? What are your thoughts?
It's really hard to break away from consulting once you're there, though. I mean, I really admire what you've done in terms of being able to be in a position to, I'll say, essentially walk away from that consulting business without having to pay attention to it because you had somebody there who you could rely on to essentially help maintain the business.
Yeah, for sure. I think my thoughts on this as well are similar to Brennan's in that I was always doing it for the lifestyle element. Well, more for the freedom of it initially. And I thought that once I had the freedom that, man, I would just totally be happy. And it turns out that the freedom was part of that, but I also needed to continue to have challenges as well. And, you know, certainly in the same boat as you guys. So the next question I have for you guys to throw out on the table is, after you realize, you know, let's say you're a consultant or even a salaried employee, what's the first step you recommend once someone has made that decision that they want to go all in and they want to move to building products and they want to essentially, I think, you know, obviously the first step is replacing their income, but, you know, even before that, like, what do you think now that you guys are both, you know, in the midst of it, what would you recommend someone do?
So I've seen a lot of consultants who try to enter into the product space, and the ones that fail end up treating their product really like a side project. What I realized early on was that if I wanted any of my products to actually succeed, I would really need to treat it like a first-class client project. Not, I'll do it when I have time, or I really had to make sure that I dedicated 2 days a week to doing nothing but working on my product while spending the other 3 days really full-time heads down on, you know, paying my own personal bills. Now, I kind of had it a little easier because in running the consultancy, my employees were paying my bills. So it made it a little easier to write PlanScope, but had I been a freelancer, it would have taken longer, but the same outcome hopefully would have occurred.
Very nice. Yeah, you definitely had a luxury of having that consulting. And it isn't like something that was handed to you. You had built the company, but it certainly was of benefit to you when making that transition. From my perspective, when I was transitioning from consulting and trying to replace that income with products, I was supporting the family. I had a one child and a mortgage and the wife, and she was an intern at the time. And so I was consulting during the day, and I was actually doing a lot of side work in the evenings and weekends to try to be able to work on my products. And so I hear what you're saying about having it work on the side is actually a big challenge, and that tends to be a recipe for failure. Somehow I was able to make it work, but it did take me several years, obviously, and a lot of failures to get there.
Well, I think that the way Brennan put it was a little bit differently than I would have thought of it, where he said that he really has seen a lot of people fail because they don't treat their side projects as essentially a first-class citizen and, you know, basically treating them as if it was consulting work that absolutely had to be done. And what I was going to say before he had said that was essentially talking about a mindset change, because when you're doing consulting work, you get this immediate benefit from whatever it is that you're working on, and you get paid by the hour or on a weekly or monthly basis. And there's a tangible reward that you know is going to be coming with consulting work. When you're working on a product, you don't necessarily have that. And it could be months or even years down the road before you start to make enough money that all the time that you put in previously starts to pay off. So it's, if you've been consulting for a long time, it's a serious challenge to get over that mental block that just says, you know, I'm going to put some time into this. I'm going to put in 10, 20, 50 hours, and I'm not going to see any return whatsoever for a very, very long period of time. And I think that's just a mental block. But I think that the way Brennan put it was extremely good, in that you have to treat it as if it was a first-class citizen, as if you are doing work for someone else and that it needs to get done.
Yeah, for sure. I think that was something within the first 6 months of starting to get some product revenue, I actually toned down my consulting hours right away. And I knew that being able to do that would lend a lot of freedom. It would basically lend some acceleration to getting that product revenue going. Even when I was salaried like a couple years earlier and I started having a little bit of revenue, I actually went down to part-time at one point, my salary job. So we've talked about that on the show before, but I definitely think that that's something people should consider. It's not an all-or-nothing game of working 40, 50 hours a week for an employer or clients and then only being able to work on the side on your app. There is an in-between, and it sounds like, you know, we all have different ways of achieving that. So I want to switch the discussion over to this thing that I'm calling the stair-step approach to essentially replacing your income. And I've mentioned that a couple times because that's kind of the first goal, I feel like. If you're a bootstrapper, you need to replace this income of, you know, either salary job or consulting. And a lot of people hunker down and try to build this big SaaS app and they want to make the big splash and, you know, start generating that recurring revenue right away. But what I've seen and the approach that I took and what I've actually seen a lot of people having success with is not relying on a single product and having some easy wins early on. So either writing an ebook, having a WordPress plugin, running a workshop like you're doing, Brennan, to fund some of your time so you're able to work harder and focus more on your longer term win like a SaaS app. And so I had crazy websites people have heard about, like justbeachtowels.com, where I had beach towels that were being drop shipped to people. And I had a CMS theming service early on. And I had some other information products that I don't even own anymore, but they were my stair step products just to get that income replacement so that I had enough time to then really focus on this long-term goal of building the products with more longevity. You, Brennan, are already attacking that. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's worked and whether it was intentional or whether you've just kind of, you know, stumbled into having these multiple smaller products?
Yeah, so it's actually a pretty funny story. One of the misconceptions, I think, is that consultancies have a very high profit margin. They really tend to not to. So now that I've kind of given the reins to somebody else, the income from the consultancy isn't nearly what it used to be, and what it used to be wasn't that significant either. The thing is, PlanScope right now, we're kind of slowly growing at about 10% a month, but that translates to maybe $400 a month in growth, which isn't going to pay my mortgage and my kids' schools and everything else anytime soon. So I had two paths. I could go full steam consulting and really throw away a lot of hours, because consulting, you spend an hour on a client project, and that hour doesn't benefit your product or your audience at all. So that was path one. And path two, which really came really accidentally, I think. I had a bet with Amy Hoy where I really wanted to go to a conference in Ireland. And we had some medical issues, you know, in the family, and I didn't have anything budgeted to go. And I know PlanScope wasn't going to be able to give me the money I needed to do that. So she convinced me to write a book. The book actually came pretty easily because I had developed really good relationships with my PlanScope customers and determined that a lot of them were kind of unsure about how to price their services. So I wrote a book. I collected pre-sales, and I actually sold $6,000 in product before the book was done. And since then, it's sold another $25,000. Now, it's brought in $30,000, which I'm pretty happy about, considering that's 9 months or 8 months of a PlanScope at its current state's income. And then that actually led me to realize that there was a smaller need in this subset of people who wanted to learn from me about building a consultancy. So I upped the ante and actually charged $1,000 a seat. I sold 25 seats. That added another $25,000 to my runway of capital. So the benefit overall, I think, of the second path is that all of this feeds into each other. So I've gotten PlanScope customers who found my book, because the book is much, it's hard to convince somebody to drop their current project management software and use yours. But it's a lot easier. It's an impulse buy to get somebody to find your book. And if your book is about, like mine is, doubling your freelancing rate, that's a quick and easy buy. They read the book. They either like or they don't like my philosophy on things, then are much more willing to check out my other products because they like me. They like the mentality I have towards consulting. So it all kind of worked out really well. And it still is. I mean, the book's still selling, the workshop's still selling, and PlanScope's still selling. So diversification, for me at least, has yielded a lot of returns.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. I think we've seen similar things with, you know, the podcast tying into the academy, tying into MicroConf. And then, you know, I wrote the book, my book on a similar subject. And I certainly see the same thing of there just being a lot of crossover with people finding one and basically liking it enough that it kind of gets them into your world. And if they respect the work that you do, it's pretty easy for them to then say, oh, well, I paid $19 for a book. Next, I'm able to actually invest a little more. And maybe I even, you know, spend $1,000 and go to the conference. And that happens next spring. So our next topic is going to be talking about the pros and cons of moving to software products from consulting versus moving from a salaried gig. And this is actually one thing that Mike and I get this question a lot from a lot of different people. It's a challenge. If you're working a salaried gig and you're really unhappy, the choice of moving directly into products or moving first to consulting and trying to build that business enough to support you and then moving to products, it's a big question and it doesn't necessarily have a right or wrong answer, but I want to throw that out there and kind of have maybe Brendan, you can tackle it first and then Mike and I will give our thoughts as well.
Sounds good. So I haven't been a salaried employee for 6 years now, so I really wouldn't know what it's like to go from salary to products. But what I do think is it's probably easier to go from consulting to products. Specifically because as a consultant, you really are a small business owner. And secondly, one of the really interesting things that came out of the workshop that I discovered was a lot of the students wanted to end up building products one day. And a lot of them currently productize their consulting services. So they might have different packages or these retainer agreements. And they're already getting experience in pricing and how to market their services, which I think is giving them a huge advantage when it comes to building what we might call traditional products, info products or software. So that's my thought on it. I think also one of the benefits I think of being independent is you can kind of, it's almost like a scale. As your product revenue increases, you can then taper down your consulting time. But likewise, when you're just starting out, you'll probably be doing more consulting because you won't really have any product income to begin with. And usually as an employee, you can't really, you're stuck nights and weekends usually to work on your side projects.
Right. It's a lot harder to taper down your hours. What are your thoughts, Mike?
I think if somebody were to come to me and ask my advice on whether they should jump from a salaried gig into consulting and then use that to leverage it into products or just go straight into products, I'd probably advise them to go directly into products. And I think the reason for that is more along the lines of when you're doing consulting, especially if you don't have a subcontractor arrangement where work is essentially being handed to you at all times, then your focus tends to be divided. And by divided, I mean you're essentially trying to make sure that you have enough consulting work and in order to make ends meet. And if you don't, you have to work twice as hard at it. And that is very detrimental to being able to set aside time for working on your side project versus if you have a salaried engagement, there's all this other stuff that you don't really have to think about it. You can just say, oh, well, you know what? I've got a couple of hours free. I can just work on my own product. Versus if you're running your own consulting company and you're doing independent consulting, a lot of times you have to spend that extra time thinking about, well, where is my next paycheck going to come from? Where's my next project going to come from? And those things tend to get in the way. Now, there's definitely a benefit to running your own consulting company and getting the experience of running your own business. I could certainly see the benefits of trying to work through pricing and things like that and getting an external view of that, because most of the time developers who are working in a company don't see like the sales and marketing size and things like that. But I think that having that paycheck, that weekly paycheck that you don't really have to worry about where it comes from and being able to fall back on that, I think that's really, really beneficial.
I certainly see both sides of the coin. I think when I get this question, I say that if you're already consulting, it's a no-brainer to keep doing that purely because of the freedom that you have and the timing flexibility and the ability to kind of to filter down your hours or funnel down your hours, as Brennan said. But if you've been a salaried employee for years and you've never been a consultant, there's a lot to learn in that first 3 to 6 months that I tend to recommend people don't try to jump into it, because it's going to take them several months just to figure all their stuff out. It's new experience of taxes, new experience of finding projects, managing projects, billing clients, making sure they get paid. You know, there's all that stuff. And once you've been doing it for 6 months or a year, all that becomes natural, but it is a learning curve up front. And I also think that if you're at a job that doesn't have you working a ton of hours, that it's actually more beneficial. Like if you're working 30, 40 hours a week at a salaried gig and they're not, you know, pushing you to 70 or 80, and you've been there for several years and you already have the clout and you kind of have the trust of people, it actually gives you a lot of time to kind of go home, decompress, and work on stuff on the side. You know, there is kind of a dependence on how your day gig actually is and how they actually treat you. And if you do have the autonomy outside of it and you do have the mental space outside of it to devote to your product, because certainly if you are working 70-hour weeks and they have you there on the weekends, then my answer would be to potentially either find a different salary job or to move into consulting from there.
The last time I had a salary job, I was working 8 hours a week and there's just no way I had any mental energy left to do anything else. So I think if I had a very cushy, safe and secure job, then you're right. I think not needing to deal with business development or anything is useful in a lot of ways. So I think Mike actually has a really good point.
So obviously you've had several successes, both with your SaaS app that you're building up. You've had a successful consultancy you've built, your ebook, your workshop. Are there any major missteps that you feel like you've made along the way that other people would be likely to make?
I know one thing that I made a huge mistake of, and that was letting my initial PlanScope mailing list go cold. When I initially tried to cross-sell the new book to that list, because I hadn't literally spoken to them in months, the reception was not nearly what it should have been. You know, conversely, I did keep my list warm for the book. If you buy the book, you get on my newsletter, and I send free advice once a week, which people seem to really like. Within hours, when I announced the workshop and kind of ramped up anticipation about the workshop, I literally almost sold out the workshop within a few hours because the list was warm. That's one huge mistake that I made with PlanScope, because I didn't really understand the value of relationships outside of a user entry in a database.
Yeah, the power of that list is not to be trifled with. Mike, you have any missteps?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I kind of harp on that I ran into was getting into a consulting arrangement where you getting paid is contingent upon somebody else getting paid. That was more of a contract issue than anything else. And sign something, not really thinking about it, and you know, they're like, we'll pay you within 7 days of when we get paid by our customer. And this sounded great. Their customer doesn't pay them, then I've got no recourse to go to them because they didn't get paid. And, you know, I sat around for, it was probably close to 6 months before I got $30,000 in invoices straightened out.
Okay, well, cool. Let's talk about myths and there's a lot of startup advice out there. And as soon as you start actually working on a product, working on a startup and launching something, having people use it, instantly some of that startup advice becomes essentially a myth in your mind because it's just not true, right? It may have been true when that person said it. It may have been true for that person, but there are some common things like eat your own dog food. You must be part of your target audience, you know, build something people want. I mean, all these things that may or may not turn out to be true if you launch and have a different experience. Anything come to mind that once rang true, but that now is nothing more than maybe a startup myth?
So I pointed out three different things that I used to believe and no longer believe. The first is I used to believe that you realistically couldn't consult or do something else and bootstrap a product. There's a huge emphasis on you need to take outside money so you can stay focused 100% on your product. And that I just think that's simply not true. I think you can multitask. You can work on both. So, I mean, again, it's a slow growth, tortoise and hare type of race. But in the long run, I think it's better, at least for me, than the alternative. A second thing that I think I've come to realize is you really don't need a business co-founder. I'm a developer. I'm also a designer. But when it comes to things like PlanScope, I run support. I do all the marketing. I do the blogging. I pretty much handle everything. No one else works on it with me. And it might seem overwhelming, but I'm very partial to low risk, easy win B2B products that I'm not inventing new markets. I don't need to have some crazy viral win to grow the product. What I found is that when you take that route, when you focus on solving pains that businesses have, I think it is manageable by one person. So my third myth, finally, and this is something that took me a while to realize, is the myth that marketing is boring. I've actually come to prefer doing split testing over writing code. I just think it's a lot more interesting. I mean, it's almost like people hacking. I mean, you're getting to see like how different variations are affecting things. Or I recently redid my onboarding completely, and I was able to see tangible financial results pretty immediately afterward. That's the stuff that really is interesting to me. And I used to think that the marketing side of thing, that's left for a marketing department. You know, all I care about is code quality and craftsmanship and everything else, which are important, but I'm really enjoying the traction affecting things at the job.
For sure. What I'm seeing with entrepreneurs who are developers who are transitioning to entrepreneurs, and I did the same thing, is you start by disliking the marketing, just because we consider it a four-letter word in the development world. Because if you've ever worked with marketers, they're always a pain in the ass because they're always making you do stuff as a developer that you don't want to do, you don't understand why they want you to do. And so first you start kind of, you're standoffish to it. And then as you start learning it and you start to enjoy it and see that, it's like you said, it's people hacking, it's engineering a business. There's like all these different ways to look at it. But once you get into it, it becomes super addictive. And I found that the entrepreneurs the bootstrappers who are actually making it happen, they eventually make the switch that you've said, where you actually enjoy the marketing perhaps more than writing code. Writing code is still fun. Writing code is your first love. But this new thing is shiny and new, and it gives you the financial immediate feedback that you don't get to see when you're sitting there hacking away, creating a new business object or a new database table. So I can totally see that. How about you, Mike?
Well, I think Brennan talked about two of the three. I would have ordered them slightly differently. The first one was that you need a co-founder, and I don't think that's true at all.
Right. You've long been anti.
I've long been anti-co-founder. And it's not really so much anti-co-founder. It's that not having the right co-founder is probably worse than having no co-founder. And that's really what it is. I just think that people really need to understand that if you get involved with the wrong co-founder, it is infinitely worse than doing everything yourself. The second one is that you need funding in order to do anything interesting. I think that there's a lot of people out there who are doing some very, very interesting things that they just don't have funding for what they're doing. They're all bootstrapped, or they got things to a certain point on their own, and then they decided they wanted to go after funding. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with funding, but I think that there's this preconceived notion out there that you need funding in order to be successful, and I just don't think that that's true. The third one is that if you read a lot of the successful people out there, it seems easy. And you read everything that they say that they'll talk about some marketing technique or something like that. And you kind of intuitively understand it. It's like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. I would have done that. But you wouldn't necessarily have done that. And what you come to realize is that those things aren't necessarily hard, but they're time consuming to learn. And the reason they're time consuming to learn is because you make a series of missteps before you kind of stumble on the right idea. And then in retrospect, everything should have been obvious to you, but it wasn't. So it's just that things that should take a lot less time, especially when you're getting into the marketing side of things, they're going to take substantially more time than you think they will, because you're going to have to go through those series of missteps before you really understand what's going on. And it's only in looking back at it that you understand.
Right. I think I too was a victim of reading the blogs back from about 2000 to maybe 2005. And it was folks like Paul Graham, Eric Sink, Joel Spolsky, and they talked about their startup days, and they just sounded so awesome. It sounded just like this romantic vision of this peaceful villa where you're just typing away at some code and launching some products. And I was totally victim. So I certainly don't think that was intentional on their part, but it's just, you're not going to write blog posts about the stuff that's really boring. And as it turns out, a lot of the stuff that we do is pretty darn boring. I don't know that I would call it a myth, but definitely a misunderstanding of mine early on. Some folks say that you have to be a user of your app, like you have to be the number one user. You have to build something that you will use. And while I do think that is super helpful, I don't think that's a necessity. And I absolutely think you can build something in other niches for other people. You know, still the low-hanging B2B bootstrapped ideas I'm a big fan of, but I still think you can have a lot of success with that, even if you're not necessarily in the niche that you're building for.
I think it can be harmful too to build something that you're a little too passionate about. One of the things that I've tried to get pretty good at is putting my ear to the ground and listening to what people are saying and what problems they have day to day. And I think that is significantly better than the alternative, which is you're in the shower in the morning and a great idea comes to you and you go and build it. I think doing that kind of, I don't want to say market research, but just listening to what people are venting about, that's where PlanScope came from. I was basically crawling through internet forums for freelancers, and I started from there.
Very cool. So the next question I have is, do you have one or two traits that you think are the most important for a successful founder now that you're kind of knee deep in it?
I think one of the single most important traits of a successful founder is perseverance and understanding that you are going to make mistakes, and that's perfectly okay. You know, nobody escapes from the business world completely unscathed. It just doesn't happen. There are people who get really, really lucky, but they still make mistakes along the way, and it's learning from those mistakes and adjusting and listening to what your customers are telling you that really makes a difference at the end of the day. You're not going to hit a home run the first day. That just generally doesn't happen. You can do a lot of things right, but you're still going to make a few minor mistakes along the way. And over time, the number of mistakes that you make is going to go down in certain areas. And then as you start to tread new ground, you're going to learn new things. You're going to make mistakes in those areas, and then you'll essentially adjust in those other areas as well. So I think that perseverance and in the face of uncertainty is really the single key trait that somebody has to have.
I think the willingness to fail and to actually go out with the intention of failing at a few things is an important trait that I learned early on. I was just thinking about 6 months ago when, well, no, it was about 10 months ago now, when I relaunched Hittail, I had this marketing plan, and I put that into a task list for myself. And I was going to try about, there were like 18 different marketing approaches, all different kinds of tactics. And I looked at it and said, you know, if 18 of these fail and only two succeed, I am going to have a growing startup. I'm actually going to have an app that works. And even if 19 of them fail, but one of them is like a huge success, you can get 10, 20, 30% growth a month in an early stage bootstrap startup with just a single successful marketing tactic. And it was actually in my head early on that most of them would fail, but I needed to try all of them. One, to get the updated experience with them. And two, because I love learning. I love trying new things. And three, because I just didn't know which one was going to work best and which one was going to drive the most traffic. And so running through all these things, I now have learned a ton about all of them. And I now have this, you know, much broader vision for what I can do both with Hittail and with future products that I have. So I think that the willingness to go out there and to take some risks and to bet both some money and some time. And it's not betting the farm on any of these single approaches, but it's investing some money and some time and learning from that and being able to take that knowledge and then invest it, you know, as you move forward.
Yes, I would point out cadence as being an important trait, which goes along with what both of you were just talking about. And what I mean by cadence is knowing that in order to be successful, it's going to be a lot of very small victories or a lot of very small steps. And I see a lot of founders who they go away into a basement and write a product almost in secret. They have this idea of this grand launch day. They launch it and crickets, and then they get discouraged and fades away. I've always been a big advocate of really 1,000 launches, right? I never really saw my launch days being anything really that significant, except that now I had an avenue for getting paying customers in the door. But there was nothing spectacular on my launch day. And I think you read TechCrunch or these different publications and you hear about these grand launches and people adding millions of users overnight. Like I think I mentioned earlier, it's a long tail game. It's a steady march. It's a cadence. I do my, you know, continual amount of blogging and producing content that helps me with my organic visibility, or I slowly build out new features based on what my customers are actually asking for, instead of thinking it's an all or nothing way of looking at things.
Right. As Dan Andrews would say, it's playing long ball.
Right.
All right. So I'm going to wrap us up with one final question. And I'm actually interested in hearing everyone's thoughts on this. We'll start with Brennan. Where do you see your business or businesses 1 year from now? What do you envision?
I will probably have another book out because there has been, again, I kind of mine my customer correspondence to figure out what problems people have and to try to see between the lines and what I could offer them, you know, additionally. In a year, I would like to fully live off a combination of my products. And I would also like to really optimize. I would like to have a very grand funnel that works across all of my products and makes the transition between each product very seamless, because the way it's working now is all of my products really target a single audience. If I can pull that off, that will obviously help my growth and my sales, which will hopefully get me even closer to cutting the cord on consulting.
Very nice. How about you, Mike? Where do you see yourself with Audit Shark, Altiris Training, Forum Software? What else do you have going on?
Well,
where do you sell that in a year?
Oh, on top of that, I will probably have published a book in about a year. So there's a spoiler alert.
First announcement. Cool.
I anticipate being completely weaned off from consulting probably within 12 months. I don't know how quickly that's going to go, but I, you know, obviously have a lot of different things going on right now, and it's a matter of kind of figuring out which ones are working, which ones aren't. I have probably 3 or 4 different things that are I'm obviously juggling at the moment. Between all of them, I'm just going to be figuring out what one works and which one doesn't, and then, you know, putting some extra effort into the things that are working, hopefully leveraging some partnerships that I've been working with people on. And, you know, like I said, just getting out of consulting, that's kind of my main focus for, you know, the next 6 to 8 months.
On my end, I anticipate or hope, however you'd like to say it, that Hittail will be at least 2x where it is today, and with the potential to be at about 3x. It's growing at a pretty nice clip right now. And I have a product manager in place that I've mentioned a few times, and he's taking on more and more responsibilities. So over the next 3 to 6 months, I expect to transition into another product. More updates on that in the future.
Nice.
Well, Brennan, thank you very much for coming on the program. We really appreciate your time and lending your insight. You know, as someone who's knee deep in this process of transitioning from consulting to products, I'm sure that there's a lot of folks in the audience who identify with where you're at, and your insight is certainly appreciated. If people want to get in touch with you, learn more about you, what's kind of the number one place they can go to get in touch with you, or just read more about your trials and tribulations?
So the PlanScope blog has most of, I blog extensively, and I do this because I've realized that for me, at least, Hacker News can be a pretty good source of a new business. And I've put up quite a few different blog posts about where I'm very open and transparent with my numbers, where I'll detail onboarding experiments and the results of that. Or one of the more recent ones was about how I've built out this runway of cash through these different products. Planscope.io/blog is where you'll find a lot of my writing. You can email me at me@brennandunn.com, or I'm on Twitter at Brennan Dunn, BrennanDunn.
Well, very good. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
If you have a question for us, call our voicemail at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.